to episode 409 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Michael O'Malley. Just me.
Rocking and roll. We're doing just the two people podcast now, I guess. We have the, if you're watching on YouTube, the much more intimate screen. You're just getting more into, you know, our minds. But yeah, on this week's episode, we're going to talk about movies that we saw this week in part one, and then part two, we're going to be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1937's The Tale of the Fox, which continues the 1930s stop motion sequences streak that we have kind of going on as well.
That's right. Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
Because we talked about that last week, and then also the story that they're working, I'll talk about it in the notes also, but it's just cool. The story that they're working on was written by, or was a story written by the author who did Faust. So it's like we're all connected through Young Critics right now.
That's wild.
Yeah. It's a nine to.
There's also a semi stop motion version of Faust in the 90s by Jan Svankmajer, like the Alice guy. So too late to do our Young Critics, but
we'll just add it in there and just really go full circle. All right, I'm going to kick it off with you, and we're going to get some more Memoria talk.
Yeah, so I saw the movie Memoria, which has been talked about, I think, a couple times. I think both by Andrew on this podcast, because
I talked a little bit about it because I saw it at TIFF, and I think I did a little recap, but that was, you know, a year
ago. You're right. Sorry. Yeah. So it, like, I guess it premiered at TIFF, right? And then has been like slowly making its way across the country, and Neon has abandoned the road show, but is still only kind of slowly opening it out. Right. Am I correct in that? I don't know. Anyway, it's finally in Knoxville.
It ain't near me, so.
Finally in Knoxville. It may not be in Knoxville anymore. I don't know. I've not checked, but I saw it. And this was good because it was the first A Pitch of Pong or a Seth Ekel movie that I saw in a theater. Everything else has been in a DVD in my home, which is not a terrible way to watch these movies. But definitely with this movie, I have a renewed appreciation of, like, the aural qualities and just of his filmmaking, and especially this movie, because as people have talked about before on this podcast and elsewhere, the plot of this movie is centers around Tilda Swinton, who is like a, I believe, Scottish, like, researcher or something. She's in Colombia, though, for some reason, and she keeps hearing this, like, really loud booming noise the last, like, half a second, that she initially thinks is, like, construction in the apartment next to hers, but is not that, and she keeps hearing it at random times. And so, like, the entire movie is centered around, like, these soundscapes that are interrupted by this like, booming noise. And there's just no way that watching this at home would be the same experience as seeing it in a theater, where that booming noise just, like, shakes the chair that you're sitting in. And I thought it was super cool. It is a beautiful movie, you know, sonically and visually, in the ways that I was expecting it to be, having seen some of his other films. So you have, like, extremely long takes, largely dominated by silence and nearly motionless figures. Not really silence, I guess, but, like, ambient noise. Although, more so than his other movies, this seems to be bifurcated by this, like, urban-rural divide. Like, the Tilda Swinton character spends the first half of the movie, roughly, in a city. And, like, fairly dense environment. And we get, like, a lot of the noise and soundscape is, like, city noises. Like, there's a really long shot of just car alarms going off. And that sort of synthetic noise. And then the second half of the movie, she goes out into the country and meets this dude, and they have, like, this kind of mystical encounter. And that part of the movie is, of course, like, dominated by the sounds that I'm more used to in a Pitch of Pong movie, which are those, you know, the birds and the rustling wind through the trees and like water running and stuff like that. And it's just hypnotic. I almost fell asleep a few times. I was never on the verge of falling asleep when the sound came, which was a little bit like disappointing that I didn't get jarred in that way. But it is a very calming movie, but it's also a movie that is like, I don't know. It is, I don't want to spoil this movie because you wait so long for like a really big payoff, honestly. I don't really want to spoil that, but like the last 30 minutes of the movie or so are just next level. I think like, it's like I've not seen all of Apichai Pong's movies, but I would say like the final, like 30 minutes or so of this movie, involve like my favorite stretch of filmmaking that I've seen from Apichai Pong. Like it is just like one incredible moment after another. And these moments last like 10 minutes apiece, because that's the kind of movie he makes. And it ends up being just like this, you know, really kind of fascinating, I guess, like meditation or treatise on like, not just memory, but also like, how do we understand what's real? And also how does this link to like the entire spectrum of like human existence since the dawn of history? And he somehow does this, like he like using these really long shots, he's able to like stretch out what the film is about, not just in the space and time that the movie allots, but like in history, like when she meets this dude and they have this mystical encounter, like the scope of the movie just slowly starts pulling back, until all of a sudden they're like talking about like memories from past lives, like he's like talking about memories from past lives, like, and talking about like thousands of years ago and stuff like that. And the movie kind of follows it there. And I don't know, I thought it was really cool. It's the sort of movie that is really fun to talk about, but is also like pure cinema in the sense of talking about it, it feels like completely inadequate for evoking what this movie actually feels like to experience. So if it hits a theater near you, or if you're listening in Knoxville and it's still at Downtown West, you should go see it and experience it.
Yeah, I agree. I could probably, you know, sail the seven seas and find a way to watch it at home. But I agree with you. Like, I don't think it's going to have the same experience. Like, unless I have like unless you have like a studio grade sound system there, because it's really about like the sound design and everything. And this is just insane outside of just the and we talked about it last week, Andrew and I did, but outside of just the sounds themselves, also just like little things, like you just pick up little noises, not even like car alarms and things, but like just like little things. You'll hear birds, you know, chirping and rustling. You'll hear like chairs moving, like everything is just still quiet. And then like this sound is amplified. And so you kind of need like a nice sound system to watch it. And it doesn't really feel worth it to be at home. You kind of need to be like in a theater. And yeah, it's one that I struggled. Even that, you know, it's struggled to talk about, but I also struggled to like write about it after TIFF, because I'm just like what are you supposed to say? How are you supposed to string together words about this? And so I don't remember what I wrote, but I just remember being like, I don't like, that was the most struggle I had, was I was like, this was my favorite movie from the festival, but also I don't know how to just put words together to describe what it was like.
Right. Well, and also, like I said, like, especially like toward the end of the movie, there's just several like curveballs that the movie throws at you that just, it feels like it just like blows the movie wide open, like in ways that at least I was not expecting. But yeah, it's worth seeing, I think. And it like, seeing it in a theater, like, and the fact that like you really need to see it in the theater, it makes it all the more like aggravating that the release, like the theatrical release of this movie, has been so opaque.
Oh yeah.
Because like, I understand the impulse of wanting to kind of force people's hand to see it in the theater, but I don't understand that like making a kind of choke point where you can only see it in one location at a time, which I think they've abandoned at this point. Again, like, I'm not sure, but at first that seems so misguided for a movie that is so critical to see in the theater.
Yeah, and that's why, like, I take shots at Neon, but I'm just like, no, it was a stupid, like I said last week, like, if a Pitch a Pong was like, hey, we should do this, and they would be like, yeah, okay, and then somebody's like, no, we're not gonna do that. Like, come on, come on. Like, why would you do that? Because, yeah, I think it just limits, I don't know, I don't think the, like, this is the only time you can watch it, and that's gonna drive people to it, is necessarily gonna work nowadays. I mean, like, movie people like us will go see it, but, like, it's, all right, how are you going to attract people who may, you know, I think there's something to having it there for a minute at, like, a theater, so that you catch those people who are like, I'm just going to go see a movie, what's this? And so I don't know, I think it just did a disservice to the movie, because you're not going to play it much in theaters, and you're not going to release it on, like, Blu-ray or something, then how, like, are you expecting people to watch it? So what's the point?
It's good, though. If you get the chance, listeners, you should go watch it.
Yes. All right. Well, talk to us next about a Mad God.
Mad God, yeah. So, on a much different, like, maybe the most different movie possible from Memoria is Mad God, which is like the passion project by Phil Tippett, who is a person that I have seen his works before, and you probably have too, because he did special effects for the original Star Wars trilogy and RoboCop and a bunch of those, like, really iconic 80s movies that have, like, models and stop motion, like, composite shots into live action. A lot of those kinds of movies he's had his hand in. He worked with, like, Industrial Light and Magic and DreamWorks and things like that. To my understanding, it's my understanding that he's never actually directed a feature film prior to this. Maybe he has. I don't know. I'm looking at his filmography and, well, anyway, what the important thing is, this has been, like, a passion project for his for decades. Like, he's been, like, slowly tinkering on this movie, Mad God, for decades, which he has finally completed and now released. And Mad God is this, like, dystopian movie that is, like, primarily stop motion. There's a little bit of live action in there, but, like, it is, like, 90% stop motion that involves, like, gosh, it's so hard to describe what it involves. It basically opens with the Tower of Babel from the Bible. And then, like, you know, where you see, like, God descending on this tower that humanity has built out of its, like, arrogance of, like, trying to reach God. And so God, like, smites the Tower of Babel, right? And then, so that's, like, this, like, 2-minute intro or something like that. And then it switches to this, like, dystopian, like, future-looking thing, in which there's just this huge swarm of, like, weaponry and artillery just shooting at this, like, dive bell that's coming out of the sky. What it ends up being is, inside the dive bell is this dude who you never see his face. He's just got glasses on and, like, a gas mask and stuff. And he's got this briefcase. And what he does is he keeps descending through, like, past the artillery, down through, like, all these strata of society that I suppose is meant to be, like, thousands or millions of years after, like, the events of the Tower of Babel. And, like, what seems to have happened is that God was not able to completely squash, like, human ambition with the Tower of Babel. And, like, humans just kept layering on things in their society and, like, evil stuff until, like, it's just this, like, gross mutated world. And so this, like, assassin guy is trying to go down and, like, plant a bomb to blow up the human world. And that's kind of, like, how it begins. There's no dialogue. So this is all kind of, like, inferred. The big thing that you'll notice seeing this movie is just that it's gross. It's so gross. You see, like, there's so much poop and gore and like everything is all like these stop motion effects, and so it looks all like really tactile and furry and goopy, and like just the sheer like pain and suffering and evilness of this like environment is really, really incredibly intricately evoked by the stop motion. Like, it's some of the most like intricate stop motion I've ever seen. Just so that we can see like alien looking creatures eating poop from another alien creature's butthole or things like that. And so it really like just immerses you in this world of suffering and disgust. And there's stuff that, like, the thing that I described to you is like the first third of the movie, and the movie kind of is disjointed, which I think is the case because it was made in little segments and chunks in fits and starts over like 30 years. So it's not really telling a coherent narrative. There'll be like things that happen, and then the movie will kind of like take a left turn with another character, and then it may loop back to the original thing that you left, or it may not return to that. And so really this is less about like the plot of what happens and more about just showing you iterations of this idea of, okay, there's like these hierarchies and layers of suffering in the world that need to be destroyed. And this, there will be things that try to undermine or destroy this like suffering and squalor that are often like unsuccessful, just like God at the beginning trying to destroy the Tower of Babel. Like, it's like this endless cycle of there is like suffering and exploitation that is attempted to be ended, and then it just doesn't quite work out. And so, I mean, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a good time, but it is incredible. Like, it is incredible testament to like what stop motion and other kinds of practical effects are able to evoke. Like, 'cause this is a movie that could only look this way because of the way that it was made, and the way that it was made must have involved like countless hours of labor. Like, it is just an incredible testament to just the work of Phil Tippett and all of his other folks who he worked with, which is like kind of a strange thing to say, like that he spent like however many hours of his free time, you know, essentially like this was like a thing that he just did to make this like miserable vision of a future in which like, you know, civilization inevitably turns to just suffering and pain. And I don't know, there's a thing at the end of the movie where this dude like sees the beginning of the universe and then sees the universe slowly crumble into like this world of suffering. And like, I don't know, there is something like really kind of poignant about the movie from that standpoint, where you've been like just shoved through all this grossness. But in the end, you see all the like beauty and intention behind it that eventually like just corroded into what it is like that you see. And there's something to be said for that, like on a meta level, about like how Phil Tippett is and like all his team of animators have spent so long creating something that is so vile. Like in the same way that like human civilization has there's been so much work that went into human civilization and it ends up being, you know, kind of awful. I don't know. I'm probably not selling the movie very well. But if any of this sounds interesting to you and you think you can stomach the like, it is really gross. I think it is worth seeing because it is like a pinnacle of a certain kind of effects filmmaking that is basically extinct. This guy has like a famous quote that when he saw Jurassic Park, which he worked on, I believe, but when he saw the CGI in Jurassic Park, he said it was something to the effect of like, I think I've become, it might have been extinct. Like he might have said like something like, I think I've become extinct or something. And like, this feels like the effects in like, whatever. It feels like, you know, if you imagine like the effects in like Jabba's palace in like the Return of the Jedi, like where except that the entire movie is those effects and there are very few like visible like live action or human characters, you get like a sense of the texture of this movie. And it's really cool. And it doesn't look like anything that could be made today. And it doesn't look like anything that really could have been made back in the 80s because it takes such an incredible amount of work and time to have done. And so you get this weird movie that is out of time by necessity. Like, it took so long to make with these processes that are now out of date that there will never be another movie that looks like this again. And so as a piece of technical craft, it's really incredible. Thematically, it's got some interesting stuff, but only if you're willing to like endure that, so.
I Google searched images while you were talking, and yeah, I can see what you're talking about. They didn't have any of the poop eating, but like just the like honestly, I would probably watch it just for the whole texture thing that you're talking about, because like those characters do look like they look kind of insane, but also with like this kind of retro-y feel. Like it feels like, you know, from a bygone era of like what you're describing in terms of special effects, which is always kind of cool on just a technical level to experience. I mean, it's something that we're going to talk about probably later in this episode that we talked about last week. You know, it's like, I think we both agreed, like, King Kong has a lot of problems as a story, but damn, is the stop motion animation incredibly cool. And it's kind of the same here. Like, you know, you could poke some holes in Tale of the Fox, but we'll also talk about like how incredibly fluid a stop motion animation film that is for 1930, 1937, that whole range when they were making it.
Yeah. So Mad God, wild, unpleasant movie, worth seeing if you're interested in the craft and think you can stomach the rest of it.
I'll see. I can't promise anything. All right. Well, I'm going to bring us home with a nice, you know, group of old hippies getting together for a concert. That's A Mighty Wind.
Yeah.
I love Christopher Guest. I've seen just about everything that he's done. I was actually thinking while watching this, it would be cool to do a Christopher Guest series at some point for Cinematary, just to kind of, we've done Best in Show, but like, I was thinking about how this movie relates to, you have like Guffman and Best in Show, which are just like funny lines, just like hitting you left and right. And then this one is kind of the outlier of the entire filmography that he has, because it is very funny, but it also like is very like pensive and kind of tender. Like the whole Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara characters are just like this kind of beautiful little thing happening while the rest of the movie is kind of transpiring in a very typical Christopher Guest fashion. But for those who have not seen it, most of his movies, I believe right now, are on HBO Max, but A Mighty Wind is pretty much this longtime manager who worked with a number of like the big 60s era folk musicians had died, and so his son, played by Val Balaban, is organizing this tribute concert and bringing back a lot of the acts. So that includes, you have the new Main Street Singers. The originals were the Main Street Singers, but you have the new version of them that includes John Michael Higgins and Jane Lynch and Parker Posey, who's deeply underutilized. Parker Posey's always wonderful, and she gets kind of underutilized in this one.
Almost always underutilized in all of her films.
She's the best part of Guffman, because talking about the Dairy Queen. But we need to just give Parker Posey like a free check at some point. Just let her do stuff. Then you have the second band is Harry Shearer, Christopher Guest, and Michael McKean. They have the Folksmen. And it's kind of the other thing I was thinking about as well is like how Christopher Guest slowly kind of pushes himself away from the spotlight of his movies. Like, he's the star in Guffman. He's pretty prominent in Best in Show. He's not the star. This one, they're there for a lot of the time, but they're kind of off to the side. And you would think that they would get a little bit more play just because it's Spinal Tap pretty much, but they're folk singers. And then, especially in his last two movies, he's very much like off to the side, which is just kind of interesting. So you have the three of them, and then the last duo is Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara, who are Mitch and Mickey. And so the movie is set up very much similar to a lot of Christopher Guest movies. I mean, they announce this concert, and then for the most majority of the movie, you're watching these bands like prepare. You're watching them kind of reunite for the Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara character. Like, they haven't seen each other in many years, so it's like kind of they're dealing with like this kind of awkward reconnection to a degree. I love, my favorite part of that whole thing is like Eugene Levy goes to her house to have dinner with her and her husband, and her husband's like thing is that he's super into model trains and like takes him into like this like giant model train set that he's built called Crabville, because his last name's Crab. It's great. But yeah, this one is definitely, it's very funny. There's a lot of funny parts. Fred Willard shows up for probably all of 7 minutes and is, you know, just hits a grand slam immediately. If you have not seen the clip of Fred Willard introducing his character in My Mighty Wind, I would go to YouTube right now. Like, I would pause the podcast and go to YouTube right now and Google or and search for Fred Willard, A Mighty Wind, and watch his introduction, which is quite honestly one of the funniest things. Where he is like working at like 150 speed and just tossing stuff out. It's like honestly like watching a Marx Brothers routine. It's just incredible. It's less funny like beat by beat funny as the other movies. But I think it kind of has, I say it's an outlier compared to his others, because it really does have like this tenderness to it. I think it probably contains one of the more poignant and powerful sequences like in any of Christopher Guest movies at the end when they're having the concert, and Mitch and Mickey, the Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara characters go up to sing, and they play this song where famously they would, you know, kiss at a portion of it. And it's like this just kind of, one, they've been going through this kind of whole journey of reconnection and, you know, kind of finding themselves once again after really not being engaged in the folk scene for so long. But two, it's just kind of also kind of reestablishing a relationship, and it's just this really like the song itself is great, and it's just this really tender sequence where all the, you know, the other musicians realize, oh, this is that song, and so they like go up and are like placing bets to see if they're gonna kiss or not. And honestly, you know, all of the Christopher Guest movies usually end with like an epilogue where they like check in with the different characters and stuff, and this one I'm frustrated that they had it. One, they kind of have this deep, kind of unfortunate transphobic joke. But it kind of sucks the air. Like, it has, like, that sequence between Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara is so nice, and then they have like everybody go up and sing at once. And it was like, that seemed like the natural way to just kind of end it. You know, like, that seemed the natural way to end it. But instead they like spend, you know, a couple more minutes doing the epilogue thing. So yeah, I don't know. If you've never seen any of Christopher Guest movies, I don't know if I would recommend this one off the bat. I would probably go with Guffman, Waiting for Guffman, or Best in Show. But I think this one is you know, a little underrated and rewarding. You know, I'm not a giant fan of his last two, For Your Consideration and Mascots, but I think the trio of Best in Show, Waiting for Guffman, and A Mighty Wind's pretty strong. But yeah. Just tossing it out into the universe that Cinematary should do a Christopher Guest series at some point.
Are you behind it?
Well, you could, because you could work, even though he didn't direct it, you could work like Princess Bride in there. You could work Spinal Tap in there. And then go through like Guffman and some of the others. I don't know. Just throwing it out there. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back talking about The Tale of the Fox after this. Je n'aime que toi.
Chérie, je viens rôder vers ta demeure. Ne me fais pas languir, ouvre tes bras.
And welcome back to part two of episode 409 of Cinematary. In this part, we're going to be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1937's The Tale of the Fox, directed by Irene and Ladislas Starovich. From a script by the Staroviches and Roger Rishabi. The film stars Sylvia Bateil, Claude Dauphin Lane, and Leon Larive. In the kingdom of animals, the fox Renard is used to tricking and fooling everyone. Consequently, the king receives more and more complaints. Finally, he orders Renard to be arrested and brought before the throne. Although the animation was finished in Paris after an 18-month period, 1929 through 1930, there were major problems with adding a soundtrack to the film. Finally, funding was given for a German soundtrack by UFA, and Johann Wolfgang van Gogh had written a classic version of the Renard legend, and this version had its premiere in Berlin in April 1937. And Van Gogh is also the author of Faust. So, connections. Released 8 months before Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, it is the world's sixth ever animated feature film and the third surviving animated film, as well as the second to use puppet animation following The New Gulliver from the USSR. The film was released in France with a French language soundtrack in 1941, and this is the version which is most widely seen. Ladislav Starovich, originally Vladislav Starovich, had been tinkering with the stop-motion process for many years. It started in 1920 with Lucanus Servus, which involved actual stag beetles that were deceased and reanimated this way. His most popular effort, though, was a previous Cinematary episode from 1912 with Cameraman's Revenge. And then after doing 10 or so of these little films featuring insects and other animal and human puppets, he then moved successfully into directing live-action features as one of the major players in the early booming Russian film industry. His career was cut short in 1918 when many involved in that industry suddenly discovered that they were on the losing side of the revolution. Eventually, he settled in post-war France, changing his name to the much easier to pronounce Ladislas, and setting up a new studio of his own dedicated exclusively to puppet films. Reynard the Fox is one of the oldest talking animal fables. Three of the earliest written versions known as Isgrimus, a.k.a. Reynardus Vulpus by the Flemish poet Nivardus, in Latin around 1150. Le Roman de Reynard by Pierre St. Cloud in Old French around 1170. And Reynard Fuchs by Heinrich der Glickesar in Old German around 1180. But all are acknowledged to be based on the then well-known peasant's folk tales, William Caxton's English translation of 1481 is one of the earliest printed English books. The film scenario is credited to Irene Starovich, but it is essentially Le Roman de Reynard as finalized in literary form by the Renaissance, especially in Wolfgang van Gogh's 1794 Reinicke Fuchs epic poem. By the 1920s, almost every standard edition of Goethe's poem had the 1840s illustrations of Wilhelm von Kulbach, and the Starovich's stop-motion models look very similar to those. I just found this to be an interesting little tidbit, but there was an anti-Semitic cartoon animated sequel of this about Reynard the Fox that was made from 1941 to 1943 in the Nazi-occupied Netherlands. In that film, King Noble has died, and the animal kingdom is under the regency led by Baldwin the Ass. Sir Ass, as they say in the movie, a tribe of wandering rhinoceros merchants led by Jodocus enters the kingdom. The film makes blatant comparisons between the rhino's nose horns and the Nazi caricatures of big-nosed Jewish people, and the Jode of Jodocus is pronounced like the Dutch word for Jew. So,
What an ass indeed.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's name's Baldwin the Ass. What'd you expect? I mean, this movie slaps because not only do you have Baldwin the Ass, who's called Sir Ass, but then you have also Sir Cock. So you got Sir Cock and Ass.
Sir Cock. Yeah, Sir Cock and Sir Ass. Yeah, that is wonderful. I'm like,
all right. Yeah, hell yeah. Well, cool. So this was my first time seeing this. I believe it was yours as well.
Yeah, mine too.
What did you make of it? Because, what did you make of Tale of the Fox?
I really liked it. Before we had done, like, the voting for Young Critics, I had just happened to have watched the other two really early stop-motion features, like the New Gulliver, and there's another one that came out in 1937 called The Seven Ravens. That's, like, a German stop-motion film. And so I thought I understood, like, the kind of stop-motion I was going to see in this movie because I had seen like two other ones that were, you know, around the same time in like Europe broadly. But this one blows all of those out of the water. I was really shocked and like impressed by how incredible the animation is in this movie. Like it is very smooth and extremely detailed, but not detailed in a way that like makes it hard to follow. Like it is like an exceptionally done movie, and even more impressive when you consider that all the animation was done in the early 30s, which would make it like far predate any of the other like puppet like stop motion animated films that came out, you know, technically around the time that this came out. Like, so this is like really like top notch stuff, and I think that it holds up to a lot of like most stop motion like through the decades. Like, it, you know, it's in black and white. And you can tell the film grain's old, but were that not the case, like, I think if this had come out in the 80s and you had told me this was a stop motion film from the 80s, I would have been like, okay, like, it's one of those like amazing instances of like the first of its kind, which I realized that stop motion animation had been around for decades, but the first feature film of its kind ends up being like this huge, like technical high watermark that I think is only rarely, I've only rarely seen stop motion that's better than this. I was just blown away by that the whole time. I also thought it was really funny. I thought it was a funny movie.
It's super funny.
Yeah.
Reynard's kind of a dick, but it's funny. You know, it's...
Well, because everyone else is also kind of a dick, too. Like, you have the Lion King, and the Lion King is like, hey, guys, nobody's eating meat anymore, except the king will sometimes get meat. So everyone's like, wait a minute.
Yeah, no, it's like a stealthily kind of funny movie. And you're just like, oh, I wasn't expecting this to be as funny as it was. It's interesting also. I agree fully with you on like just the technical level, like the way that you get some of that, just the fluidity and the flow of like how the characters move. Is incredibly impressive. They had like this, you have this sequence early in the film where Reynard is like, he's like gotten the wolf's tail stuck in the ice, and so then he's like he's like running to different towns letting people know there's a wolf out there. And so you have these like townspeople like kind of congregating to follow him, and then he's running ahead, and like he's supposed to, you know, that he's supposed to be running really fast, and there's just like this very like, you know, crazy, you know, forward momentum animation to him. And then you have these human puppets who are kind of chasing after him, who are not completely formed, or they a little bit look like a blur, just because it's supposed to be like this large group running, and it's just like, yeah, you're like, what the hell, like how the hell did he make that happen? And then you just think of like that whole climax sequence, which is super cool, of them where Reynard's like stuck up in the or he's like holed up in this castle, and it's like him and his son.
Yeah, and they're just like battling it out. There's like this really funny.
Well, it's like sequence. it's like you know, Home Alone like to the max, you know.
Yeah, like it's like got a Looney Tunes kind of cadence to it, because you have like, there's like several scenes where like people are. Or there's like this one shot in particular where people keep trying to come in through these windows, and he keeps pressing different buttons, and these contraptions keep like dropping down hammers to like bop them out the window again. And it was so funny.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's just kind of fun to watch. And like, he has like Reinhardt's up there with the different contraptions and it, like, signals when somebody's, like, entered the door and he hits the contraption. They get, like, slapped with it. You know, yeah, it feels like Looney Tunes. It feels like, it almost feels like some type of, like, some type of, like, arcade game to a degree, because it's just like hitting levers and like having to like knock the people out of the windows and such. No, it's just, there's so many sequences that are just so, you would even, you know, if you said this was made in the 80s or this was made in the 90s, you'd be like, oh, this is cool. But I'm like, no, the fact that this was made like 1930, because that's all when all the animation happened. They just added the soundtrack and stuff later. So it's like, so 1930 was when they animated this. That's utterly insane.
It is. Like, it's so incredibly good. I think also, though, the time period in which it's made, it's kind of like those like first few Disney films, like Snow White and Pinocchio or whatever, where because of the era in which it was made, it's like kind of really dark and messed up in ways that probably if it were made later wouldn't have been the case. Like, and I assume that this is from like the folk tales, which I'm not like super familiar with. I like knew they existed, but I've never read them. But like, you get stuff where like for instance, when the decree is made that you can't eat meat, like we see the corpses of animals that have been eaten, and there's this like, it's like a gag almost where like they're like, oh no, something really bad happened to the, is it a chicken? They're like, oh no, this chicken's been eaten. And so they bring it in and the chicken's like covered in like a shroud that has like a picture of a chicken skeleton on it. You're like, okay, there, I guess there's a dead chicken under there. And then like the shroud gets pulled back and it's just a chicken skeleton, like an actual chicken skeleton under there. And then like one of the birds goes like, mama, right? Doesn't that happen?
It's just, yeah, something like that. You're just like, oh my god. Well, like, you have the dream sequence where Reynard's like dreaming on like they're having like this kind of fight jousting thing between him and Wolf, and you know, at one point he's kind of losing to the wolf, and like the little wolf, his like kids are little wolf kids are like cheering, and then like he's able to turn the tide and like stabs him in the back, and the kids just like leave, and you're like, oh my god, like all these kids are just like at this like little, you know, medieval setup to watch these people kill themselves, or these animals kill themselves to death.
Yeah,
I was just like, Jesus.
It's like, it's got the like playfulness of like, you know, that kind of like early like Looney Tunes sort of stuff, with also like none of the kind of like rubbery, you know, kind of safety feeling of Looney Tunes. You know, because like in Looney Tunes, like characters get like bopped around and stuff, and they're always okay, generally. But in this, like, there's like the real tangible feeling of like these animals being physical things, like animals, which is maybe like a testament to like the, like what the specific effect of stop motion is, but like when these animals like hit each other and stuff, it feels like they hit harder than like in a cartoon where like you might have the characters like bodies stretch out and be rubbery and stuff.
No, I think that's just like the nature of the puppet too, because yeah, whenever they're fighting them in that castle, like they'll just get hit with like a brick and just be like like just flop, you just flop off the edge. It's just crazy. You mentioned Disney and Snow White,
which also came out this year, 1937.
Yeah, it came out. This one came out 8 months before. So take that, Walt Disney. But it's interesting. This one I was reading, there's not a lot of stuff, which I'm honestly like, I would read a whole history of like the making and release and all that stuff of this movie because it seems fascinating. But there's not much really out there right now. But I was, they were talking about like the influence it had. And I think, you know, it was very influential on a number of, you know, early kind of animated projects in terms of like character designs. And like we're talking about like the whole kind of Looney Tunes vibe of it. You can tell if you kind of see, you can kind of see a little bit of the remnants of something like the Disney's Robin Hood, which they kind of lifted a lot of Reynard the Fox stuff onto that for that character. But also, I think just kind of in, in the character of Robin Hood compared to Reynard. I mean, Robin Hood is a much more subdued character than Reynard. He's not over there, you know, just fucking with people's families. But you can see a lot.
But he's still a kind of anti-authority like figure who's stirring things up.
Yeah, and then you know, you kind of have almost a direct reference to the end of that movie when the king and a couple other people are like digging in the dirt to find like this treasure or whatever that Reynard promised them. And it reminds you of like the end of Robin Hood when the Sheriff of Nottingham and Prince John and them are sitting there like, you know, in their chain gang doing I forgot if they're digging or if they're mining or something. But yeah, you can see a lot of that imprint. Or I was just wondering if you saw any of that imprint in this movie.
I hadn't thought about that, but now that you mention it, you're right. I mean, like, the really obvious thing is Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is, like, the other stop-motion Fox movie. And I would be shocked if Wes Anderson hasn't cited this movie anywhere.
He would have to, and that's the one I also saw. A lot of Letterboxd people were saying like this is like a 1930s Fantastic Mr. Fox, and you're like, yeah, but this is kind of dark.
Yeah, I actually, on that note, so you shared an essay with me that I read a little. I'm not gonna like remember all the details from the essay, but it's an essay by someone named Julie McGowan or McCown. I don't know. I'm sorry, Julie. McCown, I think. But anyway, it's called Animating the Corpse, the Sutured Hybridity of Animal Puppets in Ladislaus Starowicz's The Tale of the Fox. And it's about a lot of things, but one of the things it's about is how the animals in this movie, like their relationship to real live animals. And there's a not insubstantial part of this essay that's comparing that to what Wes Anderson does in Fantastic Mr. Fox. And one thing that the author of this essay talks about is these animals are like, we're constantly being called attention to the fact that these are like living animals, right? They're like almost like taxidermied animals brought to life, because you have like the skeletons that we see, and like there's a lot of just the way that it looks. You know, a lot of these animals were made with like actual furs and stuff. Like, they're not actually taxidermied animals, but in terms of how the puppets are made, it used you know, some of them used animal fur and that sort of thing. And so there's like, you know, in terms of like the tactile feel of this movie, and like in terms of like how this movie frames the bodies of these animals, they resemble, they're anthropomorphized, but it's also highly foregrounding like the animalness of them, which is something that, like, compared to Fantastic Mr. Fox, where there is like an animalness about them, they're much more like made to be genteel, and there's like kind of distancing element as well. Like, so when an animal dies in Fantastic Mr. Fox, the little X's go over their eyes and that's it, right? And which is like a fun, like cartoony thing, but when an animal dies in this, you see its skeleton. And I thought that was interesting, that like this movie is so much closer in terms of like the material that made it, and the way that that material has resulted in the way that these animals are presented, that they're closer to reanimated corpses than like puppets. And that's like of a piece with this filmmaker's previous stuff, like reanimating like dead beetles and stuff, which like I thought was an interesting point. And I mean, Fantastic Mr. Fox is interesting because it's way more distanced. You know, like the moments in which the animals erupt into their animalness are like aberrations that are kind of like played for like comedy, and there's like some thematic stuff there. But in this movie, there's so much more animal-like all the time. That was an interesting point that essay made.
Which is interesting also, because I've watched like some of the behind-the-scenes things for Fantastic Mr. Fox, and one of the things Wes Anderson had like the actors do, whether it was George Clooney or Meryl Streep or whom have you, like he had, like if you watch on the bonus features on the Criterion disc, that, you know, they have scenes of like George Clooney like running in like a field, acting out the sequences, or like, you know, Bill Murray and in Wes Anderson kind of, you know, acting out a scene with Wes Anderson standing in for the George Clooney character. But it was interesting that like a lot of the stuff, so like, you know, you didn't get that from this one, but like it's cool that like Fantastic Mr. Fox almost took it to a different level where the human actors playing these animals like had to like engage with that level to a degree, because he took a lot of the filming that he did for that and gave that to the animators to kind of use as reference points. And so it's kind of like cool how it's also working off of reality in a way similar to what Tale of the Fox is doing.
I'm curious. I'd be curious. I mean, 'cause a lot of like early animation is they did a live action reenactment, and then the animators used that to draw or rotoscope or things like that. And I'm curious if there's any sort of basis for like this, or if like stop motion has a different, I don't know. I know so much less about like the production techniques of stop motion than like drawn like cell animation. And I think the reason for that is just growing up, I would watch like through the credits on like Disney movies, and they'd have the little like featurettes or whatever. And those are of course all hand drawn. And I know comparatively little about like how like early stop motion was done. But I would be curious if there was any like real life, like live action references beyond just like, oh, I want this to look like a beaver, and so we're going to make a beaver.
There might be, because, I mean, even for the hand-drawn stuff that Disney, I mean, Disney had somebody who, you know, they had an actress come in to, be, you know, play Tinkerbell parts, and they had an actress come in to play Alice in Wonderland parts and Little Mermaid. You know, like, they would, I don't know, well, like maybe not as far back as, or far recent as Little Mermaid, but I mean,
yeah, but
for
like Alice in Wonderland,
Jungle Book, things like that. Like they had people, actors and actresses come in and like act out the stuff to all, and also give them like a reference of how to kind of make the character look.
Right.
So
I would be
that
curious.
Might just be standard.
It's also interesting too. I've mentioned this before, but I think it's like really important if you're like interested in the history of animation to get outside of the United States, because the United States, like Disney, is just so monolithic. And most of the animation in the United States connects back to Disney in some ways. Like they were either got their start at Disney, or they looked at Disney and tried to replicate their techniques or whatever. Like the fact of like the Walt Disney Company's existence and like complete hegemony over American animation, like there's been so until fairly recently, there's been so little like alternative modes in American animation. But what that, I feel like I didn't have growing up, what I didn't have a good understanding of, even though sometimes I would see movies like this repackaged with like English dubs, like for cheap or whatever, is that like there's whole other schools of animation that like basically have no evolutionary connections to like Disney production techniques. And like this movie, like all the production was done in, you know, the late 20s and early 30s, like all the animation. And I mean, even if they had wanted to copy Walt Disney, they almost couldn't have, because it was barely a company back then, you know, like they only had a few shorts. And so I just think it's always really interesting to see like alternative strands. And one of the things that is fascinating to me is how much larger stop motion, like with like doll animation, has played in European animation compared to American, because you have like the really robust like Czech tradition of stop motion animation. Russia has a lot of like stop motion stuff. This is like a Russian, French, German production, I guess. And those all have like, you know, they all basically have stop motion films before they have like cell animated, like drawn films for animation. And I just think that that's like a really interesting like evolutionary path for animation to take, because it is so drastically different from like what American animation, like the direction that took. And so it's always cool to see a movie like this, like going back and seeing like, okay, what were like the techniques? What were the ways that they, you know, told stories in this format? And one of the things I've noticed, I guess this is true of Disney films as well, but they lean really heavily on like the folk fairy folktale. Like the other one I talked about, like the German one, the Seven Ravens, is based on a Brothers Grimm story, and maintains a lot of that like kind of bizarre like storytelling beats, and obviously this one has all the other folk stuff as well.
There might be this writing or something already, but I'd be curious to like what you're talking about, tracking like the history of stop motion animation, because yeah, I think for the most part, even more than other animated things, it really did lean on, you know, fairy tales and folk tales and things like that, because it was like, oh, like this, it needed this to kind of, like this mode to kind of, you know, feel genuine to the text. And that's kind of, you know, what, you know, you think you fast forward even to like modern stop motion people like Laika, you know, they're making movies that feel like, I mean, you could probably make it regularly animated, and some of them you could probably make live action, but like they utilize the medium of stop motion to kind of add that extra layer, that extra, and honestly like enhances just kind of the storytelling element of it. Because you think of something, you know, like Coraline, you could probably make a live action Coraline movie, you could probably make just a like a, you know, regular digitally animated version of Coraline, but there's something that like adds that texture to the story, that it's that you have this kind of stop motion quality. And it would be interesting to kind of see how the animation form was kind of pigeonholed for a long time to be things like that, like stories like The Tale of the Fox or something of that ilk, or if the, you know, or if people are kind of have found ways to kind of branch off a little bit and try different methods. I mean, I'm trying to think of something. Was that movie, Mary and Max, was that stop motion? Have you ever seen that one?
Yeah, one was, I mean, there's of course the what's his name? He directed Coraline, but,
Henry Selick.
Yeah. There's all the Selick, stuff. There's the Rankin Bass stuff, in America as well, which is kind of folktale-y. I think like, I mean, thinking about the actual like techniques, I mean, the thing about drawn animation is it is complete control, right? Like, and you are allowed like this like level of fluidity and control over what it is that makes it very conducive to telling these kind of the stories that Disney tended to tell, which are like very pure, very like musical stories. Whereas stop motion, there's an element of chaos and lack of control there, because everything you touch changes. And like if you watch like King Kong, for instance, all the stop motion there, his fur is like constantly just moving because you couldn't move his arms without also ruffling his fur. And I think a lot of stop motion has that has that feeling of being like on the edge of like the movie losing control of itself. And that's like a very particular thing about stop motion that I think makes it harder to tell stories that are like pure and comfortable, like the stories that Disney would tell. And when they are trying to be like that, it's really easy for them to become uncanny, which is, I think, like some of the Rankin Bass stuff looks kind of uncanny when it tries to be really sweet. And so you have, like, it feels natural to tell these kind of, like, kind of macabre and bizarre folktales, maybe, instead of maybe a more modern kind of, like, you know, a story with, like, I don't know, the kind of purity of, like, a Disney movie. Maybe that's not true, but...
Well, that's I'm just kind of wondering, because I'm thinking about like the example of some of the, you know, some of the non Miyazaki Ghibli options compared to like Disney. You know, Disney even now still is like very like engaged in like the fantastical level. It has to be kind of like that. And I just think about how just so like wonderfully animated and had to be animated films that Ghibli's made, whether it's Grave of the Fireflies, whether it's Only Yesterday, things like that, where like again, like, that those could have been live action movies, but like the decision to make them animated kind of also added this extra layer to it and kind of pushed the boundaries of it. Doesn't, like, animated movies don't have to just be, you know, just fantastical fantasies and folk tales and fairy tales and things like that. Like, you can also tell, you know, real, you know, human reality-based stories, but use the medium to kind of add this element of fantasy to a degree. You know, I think of, like, sequences in both of those movies where it's still engaging with the, you know, the reality of the situations, but it also kind of adds this level of fantasy that animation allows, that kind of enriches it. And I just wonder if I guess I'm wondering if stop motion has been able to do that, or if, like you're saying, it's kind of stuck in this mode because that just seems more natural to the mechanics of how you create it.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, there's been films like Anomalisa that was, I mean, that mostly could have been live action, but there was something about, like, the 3D printed puppets in that movie that, again, like, there's that kind of sense of the slightly, like, uncanny. And there's, of course, like, the whole scene where they, like, take off their mask, and that's really unsettling. And I guess you could have done that as a special effect in a live action movie, but having them as puppets and then kind of removing the like, human texture from the puppet, like, that's something that is very specific to stop motion. Like, the kind of the way you can peel back the puppets because they're physical material, as opposed to, you know, it just being an effect in live action or in a drawn movie where, well, everything is drawn, including, like, whatever you're saying is breaking the medium, so it doesn't have that same effect. I don't know. But yeah, you're right. I guess there's not been, I don't know, I'd have to think about stories that are like, not, like, fantasy on some level and are stop motion.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's always interesting to see, especially animated movies of any form, kind of tackle that stuff. I don't know. I mentioned Ghibli, but there's a gazillion other examples. There's a bunch of other examples as well. Again, if you kind of break from, like, the Disney mold. But, yeah. It would be interesting if Disney would, like, take the creative freedom to, you know, initiative to kind of make one of those types of movies, but it wouldn't make any money. So.
Yeah, Disney is sitting on the largest pile of cash in history, and they're making the most conservative aesthetic choices of their history as well, and it is driving me crazy. That's a whole nother rabbit trail, but if you're going to control everything, why don't you use your power for at least a little bit of good?
Or at least it doesn't be good, just, you know, some, make it a little interesting.
Right. So. Where are our treasure planets and Atlantises?
We want them back. Any last thoughts on Tale of the Fox?
This movie's good. I watched it on YouTube. I don't know how you watched it, but...
Yeah, no, that's probably the only way you can watch it. There's a really nice cut of it.
It is really nice. It's one of those where it's like Tale of the Fox best version. Like, I think that's what it's mm-hmm. called.
And it's a great version.
The one that I watched. And it is a good version. It's like... I was prepared for it to be really muddy and... not awesome, but it's good. I would recommend people watch it.
It's an hour. Like, I mean, it's not. I don't know. If you're into animation, you should take the hour to just watch it. I think it's. You may not love the movie itself, but I think you'll enjoy the technical process of it. It's cool. Well, nice. Well, that'll wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where you can see all the movies that we talked about in this episode. If you would like to support the podcast, you can head over to patreon.com/cinematary. We got a $1 tier and a $5 tier, whatever you would feel like you want to give, and you can do it like a one-time thing, you can do it per month, whatever. You know, we're always happy to kind of see support from our fans, we'll take whatever you got. But thank you to our patrons, Cam, Chad Newsom, Corey Willingham, Candace Sisson, Ron Hayes, Teresa Marsathi, Titus Arthur, and Tyler Chandler. Thank you so much for your patronage. Next week, we're going to be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with probably my favorite out of the whole thing. Like, I saw this movie for the first time, I think it was last year, and I was like, this movie slaps. And that is The Treasure of the Sierra Madre from 1948.
This movie does slap.
It's so goddamn good.
It does indeed.
So we'll be back with that. It's, if you want, like, seriously, like, go to HBO Max and watch it. Like, it's like one of those where you're just like, this is a movie. I don't know.
It is a movie and a good one.
But until next week, thank you all for listening. We'll see you then.